You are listening to episode 122 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, 30 years of computer-aided analytics.
Welcome to episode 122 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is January the 26th, 2014. I'm a decaffeinated Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my Mac-using brother, James Furlough.
Hey! It's good to be back.
Perfect timing on that. Paul Barone.
Mm-hmm. That's really good.
Yeah. So, first off, you know, happy birthday to the Macintosh. It's 30 years old nowadays.
Yeah, it's getting up there.
But
I saw this this quote. It was pretty good. It said, you know, when the Macintosh was launched 30 years ago, there was a lot of question as to whether or not everybody needed to have a PC on their desk. And it goes, and 30 years later, we're still asking that question. Yeah.
I think the answer is, oh, well, it's
in a post-PC era.
Oh, no. That's weird. That's actually, that's interesting.
It's kind of cool.
It is cool. And what's really fascinating about that question is it's actually asking it for the same exact reason. You know, they're so wicked powerful. What would you ever need that for? And that was the reason why 30 years ago, you know, they were asking that question. That's the reason why we're asking the question today. Maybe we need less. That's intriguing. Maybe we'll answer that age-old question today so that we can just stop, not lose another 30 years asking it.
Maybe.
How was the Disneyland? Disney World.
The land that is Disney?
The world
it was,
of Disney.
Pretty good. Can you see that? Can you see what I'm rocking there?
It's Mickey Mouse. I think we are officially breaking copyright infringement rules or something. You're going to get us sued.
Nah, it's good. It's good. I think I own some Disney stock in my mutual fund, so it's all fine.
That's cool. I'm an owner,
it's
guys.
All fine. I have an article that I want to talk about right out the gate related to Disney. But Disney World was good. I listened to your episode as well while I was gone.
Yeah.
It was nice. I appreciated the SimCity shout out on my behalf.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was good.
I knew if you had been here, man.
The guy was like, why are we even talking about this? You're like, well, yeah. We're doing this for when James listens.
Yeah.
It's like,
it's sort of like when you talk about BlackBerry when I'm not here. It's just, you know, there are some topics on this show that, you know, you just know they matter to us and we talk about them. So that's what we talk about. And this week, like every week, you know, when we talk about those types of technology, we'll be continuing to talk about that. And, man, I totally – you know, I'm going to start that over again. That was awful. I totally
– make it happen.
I had it, like, written out for me. This week, like every week, we're going to be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera or the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and, of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure he wants to throw at us.
Yes.
I didn't
know you were getting ready to say.
No.
Oh, all right.
Go for it.
I felt like you were going to.
I was going to wait. Sorry.
I work for HP, but I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions.
Nice. Yeah, I'm usually like right at the trail end of finishing a Red Bull right about now. You get to put up with this for. See, last week was actually.
So what was the reason for you to decide to go caffeine free? And is
actually,
it a permanent deal, or are you just doing it for like a week?
It's a 3-week deal. It started last Sunday was my first day, and it's kind of like a holistic. It's a diet I'm doing with a bunch of my friends, where my health nutty friends, where you like it's basically like a crazy vegan, like overly vegan diet, because you're not even doing like leavened bread. I don't know. It's but it's basically a vegan diet for 3 weeks and water only. So, you know, it's supposed to make you.
What's the reason for doing it?
I don't know. It's supposed to make you be healthier, feel healthier, detox your body, and lose a couple of pounds. I don't know. And you're supposed to feel good.
Sure.
It's I've always thought that it was fun.
So how do you feel? That's the question.
Droggy. I feel droggy. The caffeine's rough, but the food has been really good actually. Cause it's like, I basically been just eating like really simple whole grain type foods, a lot of like beans, ton of vegetables and fruits and stuff. So the food's been really good and, you know, I've been losing weight doing it, which is cool. Cause the last couple of pounds have been really kind of tough, but it's like, you know, body's like this crazy machine and there's all this great food out there. So it's fun to experiment with stuff and, you know, get that going. Yeah. That's cool.
I've always been a fan of the, paleo diet myself, you know, which, you know, emphasizes whole foods and lean meats, a lot less carbs, not to say none, but a lot less, like almost no sugars. And I mean, that's kind of the secret, right? Eat a whole lot less in general, cut out carbs and sugar, and chances are you'll lose weight.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's something magical, and it's fun. I mean, it's cool because it's like my diet is pretty stable and healthy and everything, but it's fun to just kind of throw it all to the wind for a while and, you know,
I gotcha.
Throw yourself into the heart of it. Except I don't think I'm ever going to give up caffeine, I don't feel like my dependence on caffeine.
Maybe this is the beginning.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I used to occasionally like go through periods where I'm like, I'm not going to drink caffeine for a month because it was my caffeine was tied to my sugar intake, and because I was drinking, you know, Red Bulls and energy drinks like full sugar and everything, it was terrible. And whereas nowadays it's like all of my caffeine is tied to drinks that don't have any sugar in them, whether they're like a sugar-free Red Bull or a black coffee. And so they're way less.
Some green tea. I gotcha.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
So there's not as much. This is just sort of, whatever.
All right.
Anyways, if you want to follow us throughout the week and follow, you know, see all of our adventures and stuff and check out my amazing mustache as it grows ever larger. You can follow that kind of cool stuff on the internet. Specifically Twitter. I am at Matthew D. Furlow, or you can go to my Instagram, which is where I tend to post more and more of my stuff, which is NextWigan4, or just type in Matthew D. Furlow, and you'll probably search me out.
I don't think I posted anything fun because I was on vacation for most of the week.
Vacay.
And whatever I did post was just there to make people jealous, which, by the way, I was successful at. So
nice.
That's good.
I got everybody jealous of my
Oh, which is at James Furlow and jamesfurlow.com.
Yeah, that was awesome. If you want to find all sorts of cool stuff about what we talk about this week, because we talk about all sorts of cool clicks and links and articles, videos, anything like that, you can go to the furloughbros.com website. That's the main page. It's got links to the article or to the episode, to the show cuts, to all of the articles we talk about, pictures of us, and all sorts of other cool things. So go check that out. Have fun. Play around on it, resonate on it for a while. Those are good statistics, things like that. It's completely ad-free at this point. Like the entire internet, it's completely ad-free as long as you have Adblock Plus.
Now, we're doing the Snapchat model right now.
Yes,
we'll
exactly.
worry about the business model later.
Content first.
We do have a store, though, furloughbros.com/store. You can go buy something.
Check it out, man.
I encourage you to do it. So as I have mentioned multiple times and will continue to mention for as long as – until it's beyond that appropriate time to mention it, I was on vacation last week and this week. But essentially, we took the MLK weekend and tacked on a couple days on either end of it, which is awesome. And what we did is we were down in Florida. We got invited to run in a race, and so we did run in that 10K. And then I was like, dude, we're like right next to Disney World. We should go do that for 3 days. And so we did. And while we were there, I saw something that was absolutely amazing, and then I just so happened to have read an article about it while I was there. Okay,
yeah.
And I know you guys had a ton of amazing stuff to talk about last week, and I was, you know, as I was scrolling through it, I was like, oh my gosh, man, I sure missed a week, didn't I?
Yeah, last week was a great week, dude.
Yeah, you were not short of content at all. But this was one that I didn't hear you guys talk about, and I was in the middle of it, right? So I was just like, what? This is amazing. So anyways, I think I built it up enough. There were people who were walking around the park, and I wasn't one of them because I didn't stay at the resort, who had these armbands, okay?
Yeah.
They looked like watches but without a watch face, and instead it had a logo of Mickey Mouse on them. Mm. And you're like, all right. Armbands, cool. Well, what happened is that when they would go to the park, at least at Disney World, they give you plastic cards, and you have to hold the plastic card up to this little dial that spins and then turns all green. Excuse me. And at the same time, you put your finger in there so that they know that it was you. And because I don't know if you know this, but what a lot of people used to do is they would buy like the 7-day pass, they'd use it for 3 days and then sell the other four on eBay or something.
Oh, I didn't know.
Disney didn't. Well, because you get a discount if you buy for like 7 days versus like a 3-day pass or something. And so people would buy all the big passes and then, you know, black market, whatever, eBay market, sell them, and people would buy them because you're like, dude, if I could save $50, I'll save $50, right? If you can imagine. Right. You save $10 a day for a family of five. You know, that adds up. So by forcing you to do your fingerprint, it then syncs that card with you, and now you can't sell the ticket anymore because it won't work.
Huh, so, okay.
Yeah, so they had that security feature. Well, we had the plastic card that we had gotten ahead of time, and you could use that at multiple parks and whatever. We saw some people tapping their bracelet up against the machine and doing their finger. And I was like, huh, that's cool. And, you know, and the little machine had a Mickey logo on it and whatever. And then when you went to go do a Fast Pass, they have this new Fast Pass Plus system where essentially you go stand in line and these guys have iPads and you take your card and you would tap the card up against the iPad and then they'd pull up your information and go, okay, well you can do 3 Fast Passes. What rides do you want to do? And then you would select which ones and you could kind of plan out your day. If you had the wristband, you would tap the wristband to the iPad and that would do it. And then when it was time to go to your Fast Pass, I would do the card, they would do the wristband. Okay, so far cool. And then we went to go eat. I had to pay with my credit card. They could just tap their wristband.
Nice. Was there credit card information?
Apparently. And my guess is, you know, it would just show up on their hotel bill at the end of the day. And furthermore, if you went and bought a souvenir, I had to pay with my credit card. They could just tap their wristband. And here's the part that I loved. They had a complimentary pick it up, and you will drop it off in your hotel room, and it'll just be there when you get back at the end of the day.
That's where I'm like, okay, so basically I have no context for how much money I'm spending. That seems like a really bad idea. But that last part, that's pretty compelling.
So, yeah, which further makes it so like you don't feel like you're spending any money. Oh, no, the entire point of it is to have you forget about how much money you're spending and just kind of go through the park. But then I started thinking about it, and then I read this article that totally confirmed it, where they are doing some crazy big data acquisition, you know, thing, right? And I'm just like, because everyone in the family gets one, including the kids, and I'm sure you can specify who can pay and who can't pay.
Right, yeah.
Let's hope that you can, I guess. But it's kind of like they can track you as you go throughout the park. And they kind of know where you've gone and what you've done and the order in which you've done things. And pretty – oh, you also use that band to unlock and lock your hotel door.
Yeah.
As well. So, I mean, it literally is your key to the kingdom, essentially, if I can borrow Disney's kingdom term. And it's pretty crazy. And I mean, I saw it and was like, dude, I would love to have one of those. That was so cool. And then furthermore, I was like, I would love to work on that project. And I did look, and I don't really want to move to Florida. But if I was willing to move to Florida, I could apply for some pretty awesome jobs.
I saw.
Because I imagined a future, right, where – and so this guy, he works for MailChimp, which is an email service, and he's their data scientist. And so he had just gone there. I was sharing his experience. But I could totally see a future where, you know, they're learning about your customer, you know, about the customers. And so, like, one example he threw out was, what if you, you know, you suddenly notice that there's a bunch of people who – like, they're not going out. And, you know, for whatever reason, they're not going into the park. They're staying in their hotel. And then you take a look at the data, and all of these people ate at this one restaurant in this time period. And you go, yeah, exactly. Huh. I wonder if there's a food poisoning issue going on. And, you know, you can quickly identify those types of situations. And or for me, it's like
one employee who works there who's not sick also. And then, you know, it's him.
Yeah. Exactly. Calling CSI Miami and make it happen. And, you know, so things like that. But then I'm even like, man, because I immediately put on my marketing hat, right? And I'm like, one of the things that Disney could give away are, I like to think of it as like an instant fast pass, you know, skeleton key. You could just use it anytime and it'll get you on any ride that you want, you know, whatever. And I know Lisa, our sister, has said that they have that at Disneyland where, you know, they'll just write it on a piece of paper and you just show that to them. You know, what if it's just, oh, let me see your wrist thing real quick. Tap it to an iPad or a machine. Okay, boom, you guys got one. You can use it whenever. And what if they can use it as an incentive thing? Oh, if you upgrade to the deluxe hotel package plus do this and that, it also includes a couple of these instant fast passes. And I'm like, that's something that has an immense value to the customer, costs Disney literally nothing, and they can charge a little more for it and just, you know, just add a couple $1 million a year to that old bottom line. And boom. People would love it.
Like, yeah.
Oh, man.
I wonder – yeah. Cool. I wonder what kind of technology it works on. It's, I mean, yeah, well, it's some sort of RFID, obviously, but near field.
But then I'm even like,
CID. Yeah.
But I'm even like, you know, when you're checking into the park and they get your fingerprint, okay, they've got your fingerprint. They now know who you are. Even if you come back 20 years later, they know who you are. Yeah. And, you know, and so you can start to see some interesting, like, creating family trees and that kind of stuff. Like,
wow.
I could totally see a situation, right, where, I mean, like, just one, like, think about our sister, where she went with Jesse and I, and they know that I got her ticket, and I paid with the same credit card. So they're like, okay, that was in the family. And then they watched us all check in within a certain time interval. And they go, okay, they all went together. And then later on, let's say Lisa goes with mom and dad, and they go, oh, look, here's this fingerprint again. She checked in with this other family. How we're going to take a bet here that they're somehow related to James and Jesse, and send me a friendly little email saying, hey, your family's in you know, in Disney World right now. Do you want to send them a gift to make their stay extra magical? Or, hey, do you want to join them? Here's a 50% coupon to get into the park or something like that. You know, they can start hitting someone like that, you know, just hitting people up like that. And, you know, especially with your credit card, they know your address. And so they'll know, like, you know, if you're a local or not, and you could just go in for that evening or whatever. I start to envision futures where they could do that kind of stuff. And you're like, oh, my gosh.
That would super wig you out, too. You know.
I would love it.
I would be more comfortable by the times that they got wrong than the times they got right. Because I'm like, oh, at least it's fallible. If it never sent me, like, the wrong, you know, oh, jeez.
Well, they'd have to figure out how to do that, like Target did with their big data, right? Where when they, you know, their whole thing that they asked was, can we tell if someone's pregnant even if they don't tell us? And the answer was yes. And so when they found out, eventually, at first they just sent them like pregnancy style ads, and people did get totally weirded out. And so they took it the next step and just started sending them, you know, they would have pregnancy related stuff and then like lawnmower ads and some other random stuff that they would throw in there. So it seemed like you were getting a random flyer, but it was like, nope, you're getting our pregnancy flyer and it's highly, highly targeted. And we just threw in some random stuff and people wouldn't freak out because they're like, oh yeah, it's just a regular ad. Oh, what a coincidence that like half of these are actually totally appropriate for me.
Give maternity clothes.
Yeah. So they got to figure out some way to do that, but man, they totally could. And they're just slowly but surely collecting the data.
That is really cool.
And so exciting. So exciting. I was like, yay. I mean, it was funny. Like, we're sitting there, and I'm like, dude, this is so cool. Man, this is unbelievable. What I thought was super interesting, too, about this article, he goes, you know, the issue or what Disney's done right is that they at least give you this perception that they're giving you something in return for you sharing the data with them. As a matter of fact, you don't even think of it as in terms of like, oh, I'm giving Disney my data. You know, you're just like, oh, they're making it convenient for me. I don't have to worry about paying and I don't have to track all that stuff. And you know what I mean? And you feel like you're getting some sort of personalized service as well. So you get something back. And he was like, the problem that the NSA ran into is that you don't feel like you're getting anything back. They're just taking and taking and taking, and so you feel this total injustice happening. Like, Disney's doing the same thing, guys. Totally the same thing, and we're just like, here you go, take my stuff, please.
I will say that there is one other distinct difference that is actually what bothers me, is that what the NSA does is
I opted
backed
in.
By the what?
Well, I opted in.
It's not an opt-in thing. It's that what the NSA decides is backed by the force of the U.S. military. Ultimately, the guns of the government, if I disobey them, get aimed on me. If I disobey Disney, I just get kicked out of the park. I don't get killed or incarcerated for the rest of my life. It's the threat of force that makes it so much more terrifying. If the NSA didn't have any threat of force over me,
scanning my emails either. But
exactly.
Yeah. But anyways, it was very interesting, this idea of like, with the right incentives, dude, we'll give you all sorts of stuff.
Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah, and we give it up freely. That's the thing. I mean, we give it up willingly and we want to give it up quickly, you know, especially if it's given, offers us any minor convenience. But
yeah, but this guy, he talked about the term that he used that someone else that I can't remember made up. It was this idea of the meat space, and M-E-A-T, as in like the physical space where your bodies are.
Yeah.
So he was talking about how the future of big data is in the meat space, you know, which we've talked about a while, and I've always been miffed that like Fred Meyer doesn't give you an extra discount for flashing your card. They're like, oh yeah, you just get the discount no matter what. So you don't have to use your card. And whereas like Safeway, if you don't got the card, dude, you don't get the discount. I'm like,
right.
Yeah, that's genius on Safeway's part because you'll use the card and then they can start tracking you and figuring
stuff
out. And
it's funny. I hate using the card because the receipt's like 17 miles long. And if I know that I don't get a discount on anything, I purposely not use the card so that my receipt's only 2 inches long.
Well, here's what you got to understand about like Safeway, right? Is they don't care, just like Target. They go, because they start to put stuff together where, like, for example, they know your credit card because it's tagged with that account, and they also know the location. And so even when like sometimes I'll put in their card, especially when I'm getting gas, to try to see if I can get a discount, which P.S., I did pass up on a 10-cent discount because I knew I hadn't spent any money at Safeway and it wasn't mine. But, man, I wanted to.
I appreciate
and,
that.
Yeah, no problem. But they know that I go, oh, that's a different person who's using it, but yet somehow related, you know. And that was just like Target; they could figure all that stuff out.
Yeah.
And so even though you're not using it, they're like, okay, we know who you are now. And I just, it's so crazy to me that Fred Meyer doesn't do that kind of stuff, because what the card does is it allows them to transcend all the different payment options and create a better identity.
Better profile.
But anyways, it was super cool, super interesting. You know, as someone who works in that space, I'm just like, oh, that is so cool. I love
it. That is very interesting.
And they've only they're in beta, so they've only been doing it for like a month, so it's brand new.
Really?
And that's so cool. That was kind of the funny part. Yeah. So I was like, on one of them, so they're like converted like all of the rides over to this FastPass Plus system. And I was looking at the map and we were in line and I was like, it says there's only like three of them. And the person's like, yeah, those are like a week old and it's no longer relevant. We've updated everything. So, you know, so that's not right. And then when we went to Epcot, they hadn't even updated it at all. They were still on the paper system. And we were getting all confused. I was like, where's your FastPass Plus line? Like, oh, yeah, we update in a couple weeks, so we're not there yet. Uh-huh. That's, I guess, the one advantage of going during the off-season. They're in the middle of changes. So, I mean, it's like it's super brand new. And so I would imagine eventually it'll make its way over to Disneyland. And then it'll become even more powerful. And, yeah, anyways, it was cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
It was cool.
So this is completely different direction I'm going to go for, but
All right. It's
kind of a cool thing. Designer Sam Mattson has a solution to gamer raids that doesn't involve throwing things at your screen. So basically what this is, this is an interesting idea that he's come up with, I think, in and of itself, but I just like the idea as kind of a larger leaping board. But basically what this guy has done is there's this device that it sits on your head and sits on your ears, wraps around the back of your head. And basically what it is it's like a heart rate monitor, kind of body monitor. It basically tracks, so it's data from the headset's optical pulse sensor is sent to the game via Bluetooth. So it's basically just a heart rate monitor, and it's designed to kind of figure out what your heart rate is while you're playing video games. So you would think this, and what I love about this is that, like...
So it's a heart rate monitor that's on your head.
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure why they went that way, but that's the particular device that they picked, and it's connected to Bluetooth.
Okay.
And then it communicates to the system. So as your heart rate goes up, it can adjust the game difficulty easier and lower, you know, based on your current excitement level, based on your heart rate while you're playing, which is interesting. But this is the real trick, because the automatic assumption is as you get more and more angsty, the game would get easier, right?
Yeah, that's what my thought was.
Yeah, so that's not what he does. The game actually gets harder the more angsty you get and the more excited you get. I think the belief is that this is designed to help you deal with your gamer rage. So if you start to get really...
Oh, great.
What?
Great.
Yeah. Well,
so I get you. It's not it's giving you a negative incentive for rage and a positive incentive for keeping calm.
Yeah, exactly.
In theory, yeah, I get it.
Which, yeah, the
game gets
harder as you get, as you lose control.
That's funny. So okay, I got to calm down and relax.
Yeah, dude, I was so funny because I was like, because I read this and I was like, wow, this is interesting. Gamer rage is not a problem for me. I don't really know very many people that gamer rage is a problem for. I guess it's an issue. But
I only got gamer rage when I lost. What did that mean?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's just normal. I think you're the reason I didn't get gamer rage, because you just beat me in fight, you know, and just be like...
That's right. If I can't beat you in the game, I'll beat you in real life.
Exactly.
Game over.
Exactly. So I just got used to the fact that I'd let you win. And
the best part is people think I'm over-exaggerating right now.
Yeah,
so
I know.
That's all right.
Yeah, so we'll probably became friends at the end. But so
stop playing games together.
Yeah, that helped. Or we played SimCity where we had to cooperate.
Yeah, come on.
I really like this idea, but what they're talking about is that this thing's not really commercially available yet, and not many games are would utilize it. But what's really cool about this idea to me is that it's like as you're you think of you get all these different what am I trying to say? As we talk about the idea of the quantified self, how much exercise have you done today? What's your heart rate? You talk about Oculus Rift with kind of the VR headset and everything. This is just a cool, unique idea for how you can incorporate more about what the person is experiencing in to change the gameplay. So it's like, I could imagine something like this, some sort of a sensor, either being built into the Oculus Rift, or you know, if you had like when Apple finally comes out with their heart rate monitor watch thing and or whoever does, but if that were connected to Bluetooth, those things all kind of synced together to really change, you know, to add another level of game control. And I mean, and what would be really cool is if it, you know, as right now, this is like obviously just kind of a simplistic game mechanic, but you could definitely see that as a really like, you know, a really unique game mechanic of, you know, if you could actually gauge somebody's excitement level and their calmness level. So it's like, you know, simple things like your accuracy goes down the more excited you are with your sniper gun rifle, right? Because which would make sense. That would actually be like, you know, the, there's, you know, in the game it auto aims and stuff for you. And so it's, you know, it you're, you know, assuming that you're calm and cool because you're James Bond. But if you get more and more excited because everything's going crazy, your accuracy gets worse and worse and worse, forcing you to, okay, when I go in, I got to stay calm because if I lose control, my accuracy is going to go haywire. I don't know. It's actually just like, it's actually a really, I think it's a unique, clever idea. And it's one of those ones where I wonder if he really understands or the guys that are designing this, how like, how much potential you could have in games, just like, you know, as this new unique gamer interface.
You know, it's interesting. My thought went a completely different direction.
Yeah.
On it, which is thinking about like gamer interest or there's another word for it, like engagement.
Yeah.
You know, where, like, for example, let's stick with the Xbox One, and they got a Kinect, and it's watching you play. And they got the sensor on here. And in theory, they could figure out, like, oh, this player's starting to get bored.
Right.
You know, because they're not excited anymore. They're starting to look around. Their, you know, shoulders have dropped. Or, you know, something where it can read your body language along with your heart rate or something like that. And it goes, we need to throw in an extra guy. We need to, on the fly, change something about the game. Make it different and make the guy go, oh, okay, interesting. You know, or you do start to see that frustration because it can't solve a puzzle or something. And right. So, okay, time to drop a hint. Time to let this person move on. And, I mean, I know they have ways of doing it in the game where, you know, a lot of times it's like they give you 30 seconds or a minute, and if you can't figure it out, you know, a hint drops.
Right. But
what if it were more sophisticated than just a straight-up timer? It really was, you know, we're watching you, and right at that moment when you're about ready to give up, okay, boom, we'll release, we'll let it go. Or, right. Like I said, you start to get bored, and they go, no, here's something different. Make it engaging for you. And, you know, and the, you know, with the goal of keeping you in the game longer.
Yeah,
so I could see something like that, and that would be very interesting. It's not about teaching you anger management skills, which, okay, they're important, but, I mean, that's not – if you're pitching that idea to an upper-level executive, they're like, dude, I don't care.
Right.
Some kids' anger management, not my problem. But if you start talking about, oh, we increased engagement by 20x, and we were able to, you know, do some extra, you know, in-game sales or, you know, whatever they're in-app sales or whatever. I don't know, what do they call them for video game stuff?
In-game micro purchases. In-game micro purchases.
Yeah, you could somehow do that. Where again, imagine someone's getting bored. Let them do something awesome, and then give them a reward for doing that, and then also tag it up with, hey, and if you want, you can purchase even some blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't know. You'd have to experiment with that. But, you know, you pitch that to an executive, and they'd be like, all over it. And then they can, you know, that's how I looked at it. You know, that's
my... Yeah, I think that's a really compelling argument for why you would want to include that. And I think mine just kind of sounds like a fun game, you know, and a cool game mechanic. But, you know, I think you could go both directions, and I don't see why you wouldn't. It's a cool idea. It's unique.
Yeah, I could see that.
But, you know, very...
Well, and could you imagine, like, are there some sort of... I just don't know, but like you mentioned the Oculus Rift. Is there some way to be able to tell that a person is becoming motion sick? And... you know, through some sort of sensor. I mean, I don't know if you need to have a full-on EKG, which they theoretically could because it's a helmet.
Right.
But, you know, if you could detect that and go, okay, this person's starting to do whatever. We need to change something or help them settle down because otherwise they're going to take off the helmet and they're not going to put it back on. You know what I mean? Be able to do something like that. Which, by the way, again, I said I'm going to bring this up multiple times, and I will. We went on this ride in Epcot, which is, by the way, presented by HP, who I do not represent. It's called Mission to Mars.
Yeah.
When/if you go to Disney World, do you get motion sickness? I can't remember.
I don't at all.
Then you need to go on this ride.
Okay.
It's amazing. So you go to this ride, and they have the orange line and the green line. And the orange line is a really intense line. And they're like, if you get motion sickness or get a little bit of queasy, they're like, do not go on this ride. Go on the green line, the easy line. And, you know, normally they have those kind of warnings, like, you know, once, maybe twice, it's on a sign, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
No. They must have said it like 12 times to the point where, like, we're walking into the ride, and they're like, hey, do you get motion sickness? Can you do this? And like Jesse and I are going, we're starting to get concerned. We're like, what are we about to do here? Because you guys are being a little over the top, cautious about this. What? I don't understand. And we walk into this room, and it's a cylindrical room, and there's like a little pod where four people sit in it, and then from this pod is a bar that comes up and then attaches to the middle, and there are a whole bunch of other pods around, and they're all come up and attach to the middle, and I'm looking at it going, this is nothing but a big centrifuge. I get it now. And you hop into this pod, and the thing closes down on top of you, and you got a monitor, and you're going to Mars, and they go, all right, you know, we're going to blast off. And it's like, 3, 2, 1, go. I kid you not, you feel like you are blasting off of the planet Earth towards the moon. My stomach went right up into my chest, and I was like, whoa, this is happening. I mean, like, I'm screaming like a little bee. Like, oh, my gosh. It's just crazy. And then you go into space, and you all of a sudden feel the lightness in the room, and you're just like, whoa, that's crazy. And they tell you in the ride, they're like, do not stick your head forward. Do not look side to side. Just look straight onto the monitor and focus on that. And I'm going, yeah, I don't blame them. And then, you know, you go to land on Mars, and, of course, something bad happens, and, you know, you start tumbling and going all sorts of crazy stuff. We got done, and I went, I think I can only do that ride once a day, if that. I can't eat lunch right now.
That's awesome. That sounds really cool.
It was intense. Oh, it was so awesome. And, I mean, it totally reminded me of the teacups.
Yeah.
Right, that we used to go on where, like, you know, you get done and be like, oh, my gosh, why did we spin that as fast as we did? That was a mistake.
I know.
So fun.
Do you remember the time that you and I went with Lisa and you and I cranked on it? I think we must have been still in high school or something, because we were both still pretty strong.
Yeah.
And we cranked on it as hard as we humanly could. And it got to the point where all three of us couldn't pull our head back. We were just like flailing back and just had to let the ride come to its automatic complete, because neither one of us were strong enough. I'm not sure. I think Lisa nearly got thrown out. And like the three of us were just like, well, I'm going to throw up everywhere. Like, I'm done for the day. Tap out.
Yeah, I do remember that. Geez. Yeah, and we put in so much energy to spin that we didn't have any left to hold it ourselves in. Oh, that was crazy. But it was similar deal, but because it was so big and they told us not to move, that it was okay. But, like, man, it was amazing. Just the
That's just cool.
A big centrifuge. They were just turning us, and you could tell that I don't know how fast we were moving. It's probably not as fast as I thought it was, and, you know, they figured out ways to make it seem, because, you know, you got the monitor that also makes it look like you're taking off, and so you totally feel like it. It was crazy. So all that to say, to bring it back, you know, with the Oculus, you'll have opportunities to do stuff like that, because you'll have this immersion, the immersed feeling. And if there's a way, and I just don't know, maybe there's not, in which case, you know, I'm saying this for nothing, but to be able to tell when someone's going to get motion sickness, to somehow back that off.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I don't know.
I don't know, but something like this, I could see, you know, being helpful with that. Maybe.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that, you know, I think we think of the quantified self, or we've been thinking about the quantified self in terms of, you know, health and wellness, which I think is a legitimate and good and is going to go forward and going to be a big driver of that type of technology. But the idea that this won't get incorporated into a game where we'll manipulate your health and well-being in order to make the games more engaging or more fun seems – and now that I'm, like, thinking about it, I'm like, obviously that's what I'm going to do.
That will happen. Yeah,
and it's going to be fun. I think it'll be really fun. So I thought this is cool.
I mean, I'd be shocked that the Kinect isn't already doing that, where they start to notice, you know, they're watching that kind of stuff. And
You see, my problem with the Kinect and Microsoft in general, and just what I've seen from the Kinect, I actually would be surprised, just because to me, like, you know, it's funny. Like I've talked about, there are obvious, really cool game mechanics that you could incorporate into, like. You know, where you're a commander of, you know, of a small platoon, and you could use hand gestures to you know, command the platoon while you're using your, you know, so you pause and you use your hand to gesture to everybody. You know, and they don't incorporate that kind of stuff. That doesn't, they don't, you know, so I don't know. I sit there and I go, and I wouldn't surprise
you. So you just don't think they're there yet. I gotcha.
I think they could, and I think they definitely should, but I don't think they are. I don't have faith.
So, fair enough.
Okay. So, do you want to do your thing, or do you want me to do my thing first?
Yeah, I can. I got a bunch of smaller stories, and I didn't find anything super big, but you know, so these are all fun ones.
I'm gonna say, because do you want to do your gold story? Is that what you're about?
Yeah, I can.
Okay.
Yeah, I was. Don't worry, they're still all. It was funny. So Princeton came out. Did you hear about that Princeton study, that research that came out?
I don't think so. Tell me about it.
So Princeton did a non-peer-reviewed research paper that went viral. That essentially predicted through their algorithm magic formula that Facebook will lose 80% of their users.
I did hear about this one, yeah.
Yes. It's pretty funny. So, like, again, it wasn't peer-reviewed. Probably should have been. And so there's that. And let's see here. Oh, okay. So what they did was they drew an analogy between the spread of a disease and the uptake of a social network, okay? You know, the idea of something being viral, right, it's rooted in a disease type thing, a virus. But then they applied that to the other side, meaning that people, like, would recover from a disease, and so they would all get rid of it. And so, in a way, they were calling Facebook a disease, and people were, quote, getting over it.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting. Another thing that they did was they based a lot of their research on the rise and fall of MySpace as well. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And there are things about MySpace that, like, being mismanaged that really apply to Facebook and just pure size.
Well, let me say, and more importantly, the downfall of MySpace is incredibly tethered to the rise of Facebook. So if there's no Facebook to analogous Facebook – to be the overtaker, what would challenge Facebook? You know, they were basically doing the same thing. There's no other social. You know, you can talk about Instagram and Snapchat as up and comers, but they're not complete social networks. They're not the backbone. Whatever. Yeah, go.
So, I mean, so in essence, who knows what these Princeton researchers were thinking? They might have thought it was a joke. So Facebook decided to respond directly to this. You know, for obvious reasons, they didn't like it. And so they said, like many of you, we were intrigued by a recent article by Princeton researchers predicting the imminent demise of Facebook. Of particular interest was the innovative use of Google search data to predict engagement trends, which that was another thing that they did. They looked at Google Trends. And then they said, instead of studying the actual engagement trends, which they have the numbers for, and they link to them and go, oh, well. So,
oh, well.
I love the tongue-in-cheek here. They go, so they go, using the same robust methodology used in the paper, we attempted to find out more about this, quote, Princeton University, and you won't believe what we found. In keeping with the scientific principle, correlation equals causation, love it. It doesn't, by the way, for those of you who missed it, but a classic error. They go, our research unequivocally demonstrated that Princeton may be in danger of disappearing entirely. They're looking at pages like on Facebook, we find the following alarming trends. And then they show Princeton, it started up high, and then their likes went way down. Harvard is up, and then it's slowly going down, and Yale is continuing to grow just fine. And you know, and so they're like, dude, that's bad. And they went, now, Facebook isn't the only repository of human knowledge out there. A search of Google Scholar revealing a plethora of scholarly articles of great scholarliness turned up the following results, following the percentage of articles matching the query Princeton by year. And so what it shows is that in 1940, they've got some articles, and it goes up to 1960, up to 1980, up to 2000. And then at the end of 2000, there actually is a huge precipitous drop. And then they predict it out to 2020. They go, the trend is similarly alarming. Since 2009, the percentage of Princeton papers and journals has dropped dramatically. They went, of course, Princeton University is primarily an institution of higher learning. So as long as it has students, it'll be fine. Unfortunately, in investigating this, we found a strong correlation between the undergraduate enrollment of an institution and its Google search trends. And they show it. It's got an R squared of like 0.54, which is not strong, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's part of their point, is that, dude, it's not. And so what they do is they go, sadly, this spells bad news for this Princeton entity whose Google Trends search scores have been declining for the last several years. So they sit there and say, okay, your enrollment is correlated barely 50%, you know, 0.54 R square to their search index, and they show that their interest in the search term Princeton has just been slowly going over time. So this trend suggests that Princeton will have only half its current enrollment by 2018, and by 2021, it'll have no students at all, agreeing with the previous graph of scholarly scholarliness. Based on our robust scientific analysis, future generations will only be able to imagine this now rubble institution that once walked this earth. They go, and then this is the best part. They go, while we are concerned for Princeton University, we're even more concerned about the fate of the planet. Google Trends for the word air have also been declining steadily. And our projections show that by the year 2060, there will be no air left. Like, as previous researchers, they reference that paper, have expressed in the past, this will have grievous consequences for the fate of all humanity, not just our academic colleagues in New Jersey. Although this research has not been peer-reviewed, every like for this post counts as a peer review. So start reviewing. They go, P.S., we don't really think Princeton or the world's air supply is going to go anywhere soon. We love Princeton and air. As data scientists, we wanted to give a fun reminder that not all research is created equal, and some methods of analysis lead to pretty crazy conclusions. The end.
Nice. That's
awesome.
That was conclusive.
And then one of the commenters, his name is Sean Taylor. Apparently, I'm not friends with him, but Facebook publishes everything, so there you go. He in his comment added XKCD comic, and you know, it's the comic goes, my hobby is extrapolating.
Yeah. And that is one of the great ones too. That's one of my favorite XKCD. Yeah.
So it shows like number of husbands. 0 to 1 is like yesterday was 0, today is 1. You go, so as you can see, by late next month, you'll have over 4 dozen husbands. Better get a bulk rate on a wedding cake. And, you know, just, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I love that. Extrapolating.
Yeah, pretty funny. But so anyways, yeah, so Princeton did this review, got a ton of press because of what it said, you know, and everyone loves to predict the demise of the king. And Facebook had a pretty good response to it. Yeah,
of course. On my favorite radio show, they talked about the Princeton article and not the Facebook one. So You know, it's a narrative that people want to believe, and as long as you are, you know, as long as you, you know, bought low and sell high, you'll enjoy these types of articles too. You know, but because that
I mean, just fun. They're not going anywhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean,
well, if their model is to stay true, they need to lose 200 million users in this year.
Yeah.
And we just know that's not going to happen.
Well, and it all comes back to, you know, there needs to be some – there is obviously a need or a desire there that MySpace is filling, and Facebook's filled it better. You need another competitor in order for Facebook to fail. They're not just going to evaporate all on their own. And there's just, you know
– And clearly Google Plus is not that competitor to fill that gap. And yeah, anyways, I mean, it was just fun.
Yeah, that is fun. That is cool.
Just fun.
Nice. Cool. So, speaking of disruption, this is kind of – these are two articles that I found separately, and they – when I first read them, they didn't seem – they just went together. So I'm going to start with Uber and disruption, and then we're going to talk about publishing news magazines in the 90s.
They go together. All right.
Yeah. This is cool. So, editor's note. Elad Gil is a serial entrepreneur, operating executive, and investor advisor to startups. He's an investor in Airbnb, Pinterest, Square, and Stripe. Elad was co-founder and CEO of Mixler Labs and was acquired by Twitter. He served as the vice president of corporate strategy prior to Twitter. He was started at Google's mobile team as the first product manager of Google mobile apps. This dude's got a resume, is what I'm trying to say. This guy's legit. And basically, this is what he's saying is the classic disruption cycle. So he's got this graph, and it's a pretty simple graph. And your y-axis is your x-axis is time, right? So normal graph over time, and but your y-axis is the incumbent value. So this is the, you know, basically how well the incumbent is doing. And so there's these the initial part of the trend is what he calls overconfidence. It is a slow. It is a low slope, but it is a upward leaning slope, upwards in time. And then you get to step two, which is sudden collapse, where there's a precipitous drop in the value of the company. And then you go into stage three, which is too little too late, where they start to make a change and you see a dramatic reversal. So instead of a precipitous drop, you now are on a slow decline. And then it goes into phase four, which is the ongoing decline. So in the overconfidence phase, basically what he says is a disruptive company has emerged. The incumbent views the new entrants as specialized toys that could never threaten their decades-old franchise, Facebook. Or not Facebook, I mean MySpace. Well, not even MySpace, but really
iPhone.
Yeah, iPhone is a great example of this, and the computer industry in general. And
30 years.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the time that the incumbents, or this is the time for the incumbent to take action and innovate. But instead, they usually ignore the new entrants or often try to delay the regulatory action or with regulatory actions, such as forcing Uber Cab to change its name to Uber. They can't use the word cab. Now, what's interesting about this? So at this point, you've got, you know, this is really tightly tethered to the idea of the innovator's dilemma, right? You know, what is the innovator's dilemma? It's you put all this money and effort into inventing something new. You start to you gain a monopoly, and once you have a monopoly, this is where the disruption becomes dangerous, right? But it's also where you're most profitable because you've already made all the investments, and you don't. So companies that we love are companies that quote unquote disrupt themselves, you know. And once again, we'll go with, you know, the iPhone was great because it disrupted the iPod business. It crushed the iPod business by incorporating an iPod in every iPhone. And they could have very easily had decided to not include music playing functions in the iPhone, just given it phone calling and internet, and that would have been a really compelling device. And then forcing you to still buy an iPod separately, but that would have given somebody else the opportunity to disrupt. And so since they disrupted themselves, it allowed them to achieve, you know, what the iPhone is today. And so then there's the sudden collapse downward spiral. Sudden realization that things have changed. Realization is typically sparked in the incumbent through a drastic turn of events, e.g., the incumbent unexpectedly misses a quarter in a big way, when its business evaporates faster than anticipated. This is happening right now with cabs and Uber. More taxi drivers are switching to Uber, which means that there are more cars on Uber, which means more people use Uber and fewer use taxis, which means more taxi drivers switch to Uber. For those of you who don't know what Uber is, it's basically like a cab company, but they've quote unquote gotten rid of the middleman, because usually what happens is there's a person who owns the car and they work for the cab company. So when you call the number saying, hey, can I get, you know, I need a cab, and they send somebody to you, the cab company takes a portion of the profits for operating the whole thing and doing all the licensing. Well, Uber Cab, or now Uber, basically does that for them. They do it all online. It's a better user interface. To quote a telling article from Fortune on this, the San Francisco Cab Driver Association reports that one-third of the 8,500 or so taxi drivers in San Francisco, over 2,800, have ditched driving a registered cab in the last 12 months to drive a private transportation startup like Uber, Lyft, or Sidecar instead. So the downward spiral is more taxi drivers switch to Uber, more users switch to Uber, taxi drivers make more money on Uber and switch.
Can't you sign up for Uber or one of those and be a cab driver?
If you've ever been in San Francisco, they're the big old mustache, like the pink mustaches on the cars. That's one of them. I can't remember which one. I think it might be Uber. But yeah, that's the big thing, is that private people can do the Uber, can do the cab thing for more. So cab drivers are getting out of the, you know, are leaving the cab business to do this, you know, privately. And as it starts to gain more momentum, it's building momentum, and the taxi cabs are losing theirs. And one of the big things here is it's relatively unregulated, which makes it way more financially advantageous for everybody involved. There's better profit margins. This is one of those cases where, you know, regulation is obviously important because you don't want people to get hurt or anything. But the regulation within the cab industry, especially in San Francisco, is so mobbed up that it's basically the cab companies paid off politicians to make it so that nobody else could compete in the cab game, which is why they had to get rid of the Uber cab, you know, name, because they didn't, you can't be a cab, or you need to, you know, to be licensed and pay money to the government. You have to pay your licensing fee, which is basically just a giving money to the government, and they like that, and that was how they were bought off by the whole thing. Yeah, sure, we'll pay you $150 in licensing fee every year if that means that nobody else can compete against us. Perfect. And then, so the too little too late phase, incumbents try to take action but often don't do enough quickly enough. For example, the San Francisco taxi dudes that I talked about earlier, them and cab companies in San Francisco are now adding new medallions to increase the taxi numbers in San Francisco. But it's probably already game over in the long run. This and other actions, such as building their own on-demand taxi app, should have been taken a few years ago when Uber first appeared on the scene as a black car-centric company. Instead, the taxi companies are responded by forcing Uber to drop the word cab from its name and lobbied extensively on the regulatory side. And then the ongoing decline, as you talk about what's going on with the BlackBerry. So this is interesting in and of itself. But... Yeah. Now we're going to talk, we're going to, this is like, this is a weird, like, week in review for me. There was a really cool article about the iPod, which hopefully we'll get into talk about later, which was predicting what would happen because of the iPod. Obviously, the Macintosh was a big talk of the town. But there's this other article about how Quirk Express became a mere afterthought in publishing. So going into the 90s, there was this or coming out of the 90s, rather. So I'll just read from the article, first sentence. As the big dog of desktop publishing in the 80s and 90s, Quirk Express was synonymous with professional publishing. In fact, it was publishing. But its hurried and steady decline is one of the greatest business failures of modern technology. Basically, what happened was for doing layouts of printing stuff for publishing for magazines and newspapers and whatnot. These guys were building an app for, you know, applications for that. So you weren't doing it by hand. And essentially what was going on was, they got into schools, and it got to the point where, like, if you didn't need, like, computers were just coming, obviously, 80s and 90s, computers were just coming onto the scene. Only big companies were financing them. But these guys were, like, on top of it. They were all over the Mac platform, and they just kind of rose to the top by getting everybody on board, and they had dominant market share. They were the unquestioned big dogs in publishing. And then something happened. And basically what this guy talks about is hubris, or as in the last time, in the last one, we talked about overconfidence. There's a running theme here. Anecdotal evidence is not the best way to objectively study anything, but ask anyone what caused them to leave Express for InDesign. InDesign is Adobe's offering. Overwhelmingly, it all boils down to those personal stories of neglect and eventually eroded Quirk's appeal and made a potentially painful transfer to another process, the lesser of the evils. In 2001, Apple released OS X, which felt dog slow on existing hardware. Despite its inclusion of crucial publishing tech like AppleScript and ColorSync, it was definitely not publication ready. But OS 9's failings were well documented. Basically, he was saying that, like, OS 9 before OS X was unstable and wasn't really usable. So even though and Quirk Express was designed for OS 9. They talk about, like, how you would get into these, you know, you'd be doing some operation and all of a sudden the computer would just crash. Well, OS X comes along, it's based on the Unix core, and it's way stable. It's very robust, and so even though the originally OS X didn't really make sense, and even less sense with, you know, like, It was still, there was way more potential, and they quickly innovated on top of that, and obviously it gets better with Steve Jobs being there. But one of the things that happened was the CEO of Quirk Express, they didn't want to rewrite the app to support OS X, because they're like, you know, whatever, this is a dying thing. So they basically told everybody, how about you go in, we're going to make a new version of Quirk Express, but we're only going to release it for Windows. Why don't you go and buy Windows? Well, if you, like, follow anything in the, you know, Apple, like, world, Apple dominated in publishing and graphic design forever. Like, that was the only reason they survived. And these guys are, like, dedicated Apple users. And so basically what they got was an old version of Quirk Express on, you know, not on on a platform that they wanted. And then came InDesign. And with 95% market share for its competition, InDesign, which is astounding, InDesign, Adobe's answer to Quirk Express, faced an obvious uphill battle. But this market war turned out to be shorter than anyone would have predicted. So basically what happened was InDesign came in and they had a better application. They did. This article goes through a bunch of different things that are interesting to me, just because I think they're interesting, but they're not overly interesting. But I'll give you one example, is the idea of
they call hanging type, where you have a text box, and sometimes, you know, and you have it lined up where everything has, you know, a margin. You have a margin, right? And usually all the letters line up along the margin. Well, when you're designing stuff, like if there's a capital T at the beginning of the phrase, it doesn't look good for the T to be aligned, justified the same way as the rest of the document, because of how the center of the T lines up. You actually want it to hang a little over into the margin. Well, with Cork, that was incredibly difficult to do. With InDesign, it did it automatically. And they came up. He comes up with like 15 different other things that InDesign did that Cork didn't, that are similar, where Cork didn't do it, InDesign did it automatically. On top of the fact that it was supported by or ran on OS X, so they were allowed to update to the new operating system, to the new hardware that was coming out. It's crazy. I'm sitting here thinking, dude, this was like a decade ago, and it's like you've got all of these on top of it mind, like, you know, all the stupid little annoyances that you had with this guy. You could tell was like really into computers, really into publishing, and it really, really, really bothered him. these different little annoyances. And so he comes up with this big list. And like I said, it's interesting to go and read. It'll be on the website if you want it, but I'm not going to read them all to you. And then came another factor. InDesign's rise, price and bundling. So Cork Express, it was wicked expensive. In order to get just Cork Express, it was like six, which is one that fully supported by OS X and kind of like the last of their major releases. That cost $9.45 with Cork Express 6 passports, which who even knows what that is. It has to do with like support and stuff. Cost $1,795. So in total, about $3,000. InDesign, $700.
Wow.
Yeah, so there was a compelling price reason to go with it. And then it's effectively basically what happened was, you know, Cork, once they realized they needed to innovate, get better technology, and, you know, build on their platform, it was the end of the line. It was too late. They were doing it for cost reasons, and they weren't giving users what they really wanted. And it was just – so it made the – like he said, it made the justification for switching, the painful switch, and allowed people to come up with compelling reasons to do that. I think that's interesting, just from a history of tech. And then he dropped the last like point of his article, and I was like, okay, now I don't know why I sat through this entire article, but I'm glad I did. Because basically he said, InDesign's Creative Cloud, echoes of Cork. And really and truly, he's obviously talking about InDesign specifically, but I think he's really kind of inferring that the entirety of the Adobe Creative Suite in the cloud is kind of similar to this whole idea. And it's because it's like for a long time, you know, basically, you know, there was the only real go-to was like Photoshop for photo editing. I mean, that was just what everybody used. And if you didn't have it, you know, if you couldn't afford it, you stole it. Because it was the dominant king in the, you know, in the realm of, that was, you know, of photo editing. And, you know, these are obviously incredibly powerful programs. They do a lot. But they've now gotten to the point with the Creative Suite where it's like a lot of people are feeling the pain. They have completely cut out, you know, mild manner users like me who might have considered, you know, dropping too much money on Photoshop because that's all I really want, or Illustrator.
Yeah.
And what they've really done, and I think was really fascinating, is they basically cut out all of the piracy, you know, by and large, they've gotten rid of that, which I think they view as a great thing, and I think long-term is a terrible thing, because for me, it wasn't until it became really, you know, comprehend, it became too difficult to borrow it from the internet that I decided to look for other options. And that's when I discovered GIMP, and GIMP is great, and it is free. And then I got a Mac, and I spent $30 on Pixelmator, and it is amazingly great. And you sit there and you go, like, people are finding alternatives. And obviously, you know, these, obviously Adobe's the big dog. There's no real big competitor. But it's one of those things where, and what I think is really interesting here is he's basically saying they are in the overconfidence phase. They are clearly doing that by their pricing structure and everything that they're doing. They're basically twisting your arm. They're giving you fake innovations, not fake, or they're giving you small innovations at greatly increased prices. And they're bundling everything together, making it impossible to get a good deal unless you buy everything, whether you need it or not. And you don't get to hold on to anything. You're dependent on continually giving them money for the next cool, you know, update. And I don't know, it's a fascinating problem that this guy is drawing out. And so the reason I bring all this up is because,
well, I think about, like, Pixelmator 2, where they, like, it wasn't a complete feature set and it didn't compete with Adobe. And I first got it and it was actually really hard to work with. And, you know, and I had to be patient and, you know, like, they couldn't do, like, shapes. You couldn't just make a box.
Right.
And you have to instead, like, highlight an area and then fill that area. And if you want to do something other than a rectangle, you had to do a whole bunch of little ones. And, I mean, it was hard. And it wasn't until they came out with Pixelmator, and, you know, and it had, like, this niche product feel. And then they came out with Pixelmator 2.0, and they went, oh, yeah, and we added a whole bunch of stuff, including shapes and this and that. And they're like, we're a full-on Photoshop replacement now.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, boom, just like that. You're just as good.
Yeah.
And you're $30. Unless you already owned it, then it's a free upgrade.
Yeah. And that's,
this is awesome.
Yeah, and you shrug your shoulders and you're like, you know, it's one of those things where I think something could be happening with Adobe. You know, obviously they are.
Part of their problem is they don't have Flash anymore, and they used to license a bunch of that stuff. And I would imagine there's a bit of a scramble to go, okay, how do we keep our revenue streams going? And
yeah,
you know, this is one way. You start to charge more for your producers because that's all you really can charge from. And
yeah, and that's, and
that's a recipe for disaster long term.
Yeah, it is, and nothing huge has come out of Adobe in the last 5 years. I can't think of anything that's just been like astoundingly new and great. No new product categories. They just keep adding features to their really, really, really expensive suite. And you just sit there and go, you know, at some point, I've found replacements for everything that I use them for. And then some. Inkscape for Illustrator, you know, GIMP or Pixelmator for Photoshop. And, you know, the only thing that I really don't have, and I have a hard time finding, is a decent video editor. And
you don't like iMovie, huh?
Well, I do like iMovie. I said, I meant to say for PC. That's the one area where I still, you know, I actually went on that horse race this week, and it was terrible, and I got a bunch of viruses on my work computer accidentally. Don't tell my boss. Yeah, I cleaned it up mostly. But it was just like, he was having me do this project for him, and I was like, I need a free video editor. And I went to CNET. I hate CNET. I hate them with a passion. They are such an awful company. But yeah, so this is I don't necessarily have a time frame on when I think Adobe is going to collapse. I'm not even sure that they don't have it in them to change what they're doing. But like you said, the signs are bad. They are coming up to, they are at a place where I think a disruptor could easily come in with an incredible product at a better price point and really, really, really justify, you know, basically do what Adobe did to Quark Express, which, you know, would be kind of a bummer for them. And I like Adobe. I think Adobe's a cool company, so I'm not super stoked on this. But I think it's, you know, hard to
believe that it's, not going to go this way.